they did this, if they're able to establish a union, then they'd be able to fight for the abolishment of slavery. The Founding Fathers certainly had that in mind.
Oh, I'm not saying they didn't have it in mind. It was just not as explicitly stated. And that's the interesting thing in the difference between the Declaration of Independence and the French Declaration of Rights. In the French Declaration, it was explicitly made this connection in writing and not so much in the Declaration of Independence. So I'm not saying it wasn't in their thoughts. It's just not as explicitly written. Go ahead.
Thank you for your talk. It's very good. I was wondering, since we're all theology students, and because it is such a hot-button issue today, whether you might care to say anything about human rights and religion.
I think the best answer to that question is to read Pope Paul VI's document, Dignitatis Humanae, in which basically, this is a very important development, obviously, in church doctrine, in which, you know, freedom of religion was seen as the core of human dignity and the core of the exercise of human rights. So obviously, freedom of religion is regarded, I would say, alongside with the right to life, where it all starts, as one of the key aspects of human rights. There's no question about that. But that would go, I've deliberately not touched that subject tonight, because that will go, you could spend evenings on talking about that. Yes. Sie können auch auf Deutsch, wenn Sie es. Ja, natürlich, kein Problem. Ja.
Die Kirche hat ja am Beginn Probleme mit den Menschenrechten, weil es auch von einer ganz anderen Seite kam und, glaube ich, bei Johannes dem 23. ist es dann umgeschwächt oder früher beim Konzil. Sind die Menschenrechte so, wie sie 1948 formuliert wurden, jetzt wirklich der ungeschichtliche, naturelle Block dessen, was gültig und erkennbar ist, oder ist das Ganze nicht doch immer wieder auch unter dem Blick des Flusses der Geschichte, dass man das Naturrecht ja doch nicht so eindeutig offensichtlich erkennen und ablesen kann, wie das man gerne hätte oder formuliert wird? Sie haben Thomas von Aquin einige Male zitiert, der hat sicher im heutigen menschenrechtlichen Sinn Dinge für richtig gehalten, die wir heute als äußerst grausam betrachten würden. Wie sehen Sie das Problem der Geschichtlichkeit und vor allem, was sind jetzt die Menschenrechte? Die Formulierung von 1948 oder die von 1968, die politischen Gesetze, die da europaweit, weltweit von der UNO gemacht wurden, was sind jetzt die Menschenrechte, die hieb- und stichfest in der Geschichte ablesbar wirklich die Würde des Menschen begründen?
Also ich werde diese Frage auf Englisch beantworten, einfach für den Studenten. Ich hoffe, das ist okay. Yeah, I think one has to have a critical
question.
You will hear it in my answer. You will hear it in my answer, because actually it has to do also with your question a couple of weeks ago. The first part is the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights is not an unproblematic document. It is, on the one hand, a wonderful document because something was really achieved there. But as I quoted already, it was a document where, as Jacques Maritain also says it, he was one of the people very much involved in the Universal Declaration, it is a catalogue of rights where everybody agrees that those rights exist, but nobody agrees on its foundations. So if you read the history of the Universal Declaration, there were people of all faiths and all cultures involved in its drafting, but they would not be able to agree on the fundamental question, where do these stem from? So the Universal Declaration, I would say, although it certainly has influences of the natural law thinking that is especially strong in the Catholic Church, it is certainly not exclusively so, because then it would have not been signed by, for example, the Muslims and the Buddhists, to name but a few non-Christians that were involved in its drafting. So that as a first point. I think, and we see that now in the application of human rights, and there basically we go back to what Plato already said, if a god is not a measure of all things, then we're nowhere. Basically, it is difficult to say that in a separate society, but in the end, if we don't have that, then human rights indeed become something that fluctuates over time and that is seen differently. You know, just to come back to that example of really serious academics proposing a right to abortion 50 years ago, you know, nobody would have in his wildest dreams even thought of somebody actually proposing such a thing. So there you see this example of indeed, you know, the developments of time where people come to this point, which is exactly the problem, because we are human beings, we develop, but the whole idea of human rights should be that they're unchangeable regardless of time, regardless of culture. That's also why I think human rights should be limited to a short catalog. So you can have human rights and then you can have other rights which you call basic rights or social rights, which don't have the same stature as fundamental rights or human rights. But I think if we indeed give in to what is the current trend to say, well, you know, human rights can sort of change as society develops, yes, well, then we indeed come into this sort of totalitarian thinking that is very evident today. Are there further parts of your question that remain unanswered? Because it's a vast question you had, so any... Because you were referring to St. Thomas.
Was ist der Katalog der Menschenrechte, der die wirklich gelten? Zeitlos gibt's das?
Ja, natürlich. Ja, die gibt's sicher. Ja, I would say that the problem is, when you ask what is a catalog of rights that has been valid in all times, that catalog is present, even if in certain times, in many times, that catalog was actually not respected. Let me give an example. The right to life is obviously something that is an inherent right that goes, you know, through all ages, but it has not also by people we might today call great philosophers, has not always been accepted, but that doesn't make them less valid.
Die Menschenrechtsfrage wurde ja sehr intensiv diskutiert am Tod von Bin Laden. Dürfte der getötet werden, dürfte man sich darüber freuen, dass so ein weltweit gesuchter Terrorist, der so viele Menschen auf dem Gewissen hatte, dürfte man da Genugtuung empfinden oder doch nicht vom Gewissen her sagen, das ist menschliches Leben, das hätte man so herauskriegen sollen, aber freuen darf man sich auf keinen Fall darüber, dass endlich ein Terrorist...
Da bin ich ganz einverstanden. Ja, da bin ich ganz einverstanden. And this is also the problem that goes throughout the ages. There are always times when even a majority of people think it is justified to kill this or to kill that person. And that's exactly the problem I've been trying to point out. Because even if society thinks that, that doesn't mean that it is therefore right. There's a very good example on this terrorism question, a judgment of the Bundesverfassungsgericht that I also discussed, where a law was passed in Germany, I think it was in 2007, which was called the Air Safety Law. And it was a law where actually the Minister of Defense was empowered to have the military jet shoot down a civil airliner if that airliner was hijacked and posed a threat to a community or to a city. And it went all the way up to the Constitutional Court, which finally came out saying, no, this law is unconstitutional because we can never weigh one life against another life. That is against our principle of human dignity and the protection of life. And it actually declared the law unconstitutional, even if it's a situation, very concretely speaking, where the Minister of Defense would know that that one plane, if he wouldn't shoot it down, might actually lead to more deaths than if he would shoot down that plane. And there specifically the court said, no, we cannot weigh one life against the other. So this is a very clear example, which I found a very good judgment, where it's basically said we don't have that right to do that. So I would say that is applicable, this principle, on many other situations. Yes, one, two, three, yeah.
Thank you for your lecture. The question I had is, I don't quite understand the right to life insofar as certainly it's forfeited at various times. In the Old Testament, you know, you can get killed for gathering sticks on the Sabbath. In Christendom, in the Middle Ages, you can get killed for denying a dogma of the church. And they believe, you know, you forfeited your right to life because of these certain actions. And nowadays, we just tend to say, if you kill lots of people and you're bound to kill more people, we'll execute you in Texas or something, you know? I don't know how it works in most, in Iran and a couple other places. But I don't understand what is the right to life, and because at some point it seems to be forfeited, but is that just arbitrary?
This is the problem of human nature. We have gone through the history of human nature through various phases where indeed that right to life was forfeited, without there being, you know, a really defendable justification for it. Now here we have to obviously make a distinction between the right to self-defense, you know, when your life is being threatened and you have to save your life. That's a whole different discussion also in the law. Yeah? Between the, you know, and the real right to life where we're speaking about. And the fact, and this is the problem, one should not take a too casuistic approach to it and look at specific cases and say, well, you know, the church did this or the Greeks did that. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that the right to life was therefore justifiably forfeited. That was a practice at that time. And this is the whole interesting thing of the discussion on the right of life. The humankind has gone through a long period of ever more trying to understand and to grasp the meaning of this right to life. And I think we as Christians only have to look in the gospel, you know, to know that the right to life is a real right. You know, is there anywhere in the gospel that Christ tells us, you know, kill that person or kill that person?
It is a condemned proposition that the burning of heretics is contrary to the will of the Spirit. So it is true that at certain times the church can give to the state heretics to execute. It's a condemned proposition.
Yes, I'm not going to go into this theological discussion because I'm not equipped for that. I would like to stick to the legal discussion here, and I think the legal discussion has as the key element to it that the fact that there have been many instances in history in which the right to life, as we, but who is we, see it now, as we should see it now, and that every life needs to be protected, has not been respected, that doesn't change the fact of this inherent right itself. Sorry, we first had your, and then Jakob, yes.
Ich werde meine Frage auch auf Deutsch stellen.
Ja, kein Problem.
Sie haben das sehr schön dargelegt, dass Sie auf die Kirche sagt, dass man diese Naturrechte eigentlich aus der Vernunft ableiten kann und trotzdem auch gleichzeitig wieder, dass eigentlich der Schöpfer eben Gott darin sichtbar wird oder eigentlich benötigt wird. Ich finde es sehr schwierig, in einer säkularen Welt praktisch ohne Gott hier diese Themen zu argumentieren und zu diskutieren. Also etwa, wenn es geht um Forschung mit humanen embryonalen Stammzellen, für einen Biologen kann das leicht sein, dass das einfach Zellen sind und es ist nicht mehr. Wenn ich nicht den Würdebegriff habe oder das Verständnis einer Seele oder wie auch immer, bin ich sehr schnell begrenzt. Also mir fällt es schwer, sagen, rein mit der Vernunft zu solchen Schlussfolgerungen zu kommen. Wie sehen Sie die Möglichkeit, sozusagen ohne christlicher oder religiöser Einstellung komplette Menschenwürde in diesem im guten Sinne verteidigen zu können?
Da haben Sie recht, das ist auch sehr schwierig und ich würde auch sagen, am Ende des Tages ist es unmöglich, das christliche Begriff der Menschenwürde und das Recht auf Leben auch tatsächlich in seiner volle Tiefe und seine volle sozusagen Gesamtheit wirklich den Menschen zu erklären, die überhaupt keinen transzendenten Bezug haben, die überhaupt keinen Gottesbezug haben. Was ich sagen wollte, ist, dass in einer säkulare Gesellschaft es sehr wohl möglich ist, rational darzustellen, warum ein Mensch Würde hat und warum sein Leben schützenswert ist und wie wir als Menschen handeln müssen, um dies zu respektieren. Aber das ist genau die große Herausforderung. Yes. So the question was, is it at all possible in a secular society to describe or defend human dignity and the right to life without involving God, so without involving our Christian arguments? My answer to that was, yes, that is indeed a very tall order and quite difficult, because at the end of the day, if you want to understand human dignity and the right to life in its full breadth and in its full depth, you come to a point where faith is needed, or the acceptance of God at least is needed, to come to its full depth. However, that being said, we can come a long way through reason, as Pope Benedict has said that, but through mere reason, the reasoned approach of reality, to actually show people that there is a way to understanding this real and viable dignity. So that was the answer. Jakob.
So I would like to join Mr. Owens in thanking you for the lecture and say that in my life as professional lawyer, I had not often heard, so to say, this type of talking. I was more subjected to all the secularist positions. So if I understand you correctly, there are, so to say, two things you don't want to do this evening. One is the purely fundamental theological philosophical debate, the underpinnings of natural law, so to say, and the other type is the casuistic debate, just explaining what the court is particularly doing. So I'm going to try and have a question that also does that, so to say. What I'm thinking is that in a way you can say political power is legal power, and also the other way around, legal power gives you political power. So we are talking about a situation where there is a majority that has a secularist conception and therefore introduces all kinds of laws that we hold to be contrary to human nature and therefore unjust. So in as far as we would like to change that, we need to gain political and legal power. Considering that possible, let's say that would happen at some point. Of course, what will happen is we will introduce laws that a certain part of the people will not consider desirable. And they will say, you are taking away my individual rights, etc., etc., etc. So I'm curious if you can say how you would argue against those people, how you would maintain, I am right in prohibiting, for example, abortion. And let me elaborate a little bit on that. And there is this famous Dutch lawyer, Grotius, who is by many moderns considered one of the fathers of natural law, because they do not recognize the whole Catholic natural law tradition. They just say it started there, because Grotius was the one who made rational argument possible. And in that sense, I would follow up on the question of this gentleman before, because he said, let's suppose that God does not exist. What part of natural law can we maintain? And that's how he then developed his whole natural law system, which completely inflated and then exploded and was abolished. So how are you going to try and say it's purely based on reason, maintaining these laws? And then in the following field, and I think from clearer to less clear, but all important. So you have abortion. You have adoption of children by gay couples, you have gay marriage, you have artificial conception, you have euthanasia, you have the use of drugs, you have prostitution, pornography, divorce, all types of fornication, and anti-conception. I think these are all fields in which it is desirable from a natural law perspective that there would be laws that maintain order in society and actually allow people to have a natural and good life. And do you think there is a conception based on reason that would legitimize Christians taking political power and introducing these laws? Thank you.
Your question would be the subject of probably a whole semester of classes. But let me briefly answer in this way. First of all, I want to stress, as I already said before, at the end of the day, I do not think it is possible to explain, you know, laws in defense of life, in defense of marriage, etc., all the way to the end, to a public that has no connection to its creator. That's just the harsh reality. The point I've been trying to make is that we can come a long way in at least explaining some of the realities of the natural created order that could already bring people on the way to understanding that. Of course, the problem we have is that, of course, we live in a society because of relativism where there is also, independent of the church or of Christian teaching, where there is no moral framework anymore, not at all, but a very diminished moral framework, you know, on which people can sort of, you know, to which people can sort of go back. And that is, I would say, that is at the end of the day our biggest problem, because we're sort of up in the air. You know, we're sort of really up in the air. There's nothing under our feet anymore on which we can fall back. So then obviously this rule of desire kicks back in. So yes, obviously we Christians should, and it's the only way. Actually, our new Pope, Pope Francis, has stressed that you know, the only way we can do something about this is if we believing Christians go into politics and try to actually you know, get through and passing laws. I know from my practice with Catholic legislators that there are many instances where that is possible, and where there are many instances where it is possible to actually rally people around the concept. The best example of that is that about 2 years ago, in the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe tried to pass a ruling that conscientious objection of doctors and nurses in medical cases, including euthanasia and abortion, etc., would be forbidden. And this one Catholic politician was able to rally not only Christians, but also non-Christians around some very sound arguments why this was detrimental to the good of society. So I think it is hard, probably even impossible, to answer your question in the general way and saying, okay, you have to do this and this and this. I think that what we have to do is look at specific situations where we can act, but keep in mind this basic concept that I mentioned, and that is that on the basis of the reality of the created order, many things are visible by reason. We just have to explain them, because this is where it is often lacking these days. It is not even explained anymore. The problem is very often many of those discussions in our society are totally hysteric, you know, totally hysteric. So there is no room anymore to step back and to contemplate the question, what are we talking about? And what we see, that in those situations, that those in political office are actually able to have people step back, take away the hysteria, and actually debate it and reason it, progress is made. But it's a tall order, that I agree. There's no golden rule for it. Absolutely not. Alan, you.
I think
Father Thomas. Oh, yeah, Father Thomas and then Alan, yeah. Larry, you say,
yeah.
I was wondering how you think criminals should be punished, if I've understood you rightly, in saying that both the right to life and the right to liberty are always inviolable.
Well, if you want a clear answer, I'm against the death penalty. That's a clear, and as a Christian, I'm opposed against the death penalty for the simple reason that we then take away a possible chance for a soul to find God again, and to be redeemed. That's what we do when we impose the death penalty. So this is actually, it's interesting, because I know that in conservative circles also many Americans, you know, staunchly defend the death penalty. But I'm absolutely not of that mind, because I think it is indeed a violation of the right to life. Especially because we have in our society many opportunities to deal with such criminals in the right way. But was that your question, or?
Well, that's why I added the word liberty as well, because you mentioned the three basic ones, life, liberty, and dignity.
Right.
So if you don't kill criminals, can you lock them up?
Yes, obviously, because that's where justice comes in. You know, when they are a threat to society, there is the justice system where obviously they can be imprisoned. But there again, human dignity comes in, and there's a lot of case law on that. Their human dignity come in, even if they are terrible criminals, they still have to be treated with dignity, and their human dignity comes in. So that's why, again, I said it starts with the right to life. Yeah? The right to life. That's the basic of it. Alan?
I wasn't sure about where you were drawing the line in regards to reason and revelation, and also to do with the justification of human rights from without the use of religious language, in that the existence of God is not per se the object of belief, because the existence of God, religious supernatural faith presupposes a knowledge of the existence of God, because we believe on account of God's authority, and the natural knowability of the existence of God was obviously solemnly defined by the First Vatican Council. So theism as such is not a specifically revealed truth. It's an integral part of natural reason and necessary for proper reasoning about man, human nature, and the natural law. And in his message on the 1,200th anniversary of the coronation of Charlemagne, John Paul II specifically taught that it's impossible to vindicate human rights without theism. He said that he was criticising the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union, which he said ignored the fact that the denial of God and his rights was the cause of the violations of human rights in the course of the 20th century, and that the rights of God and man stand and fall together. And in fact, the Catechism goes even further in its ear. I think it's paragraph 2244, says that if the state fails to recognize or rejects the inspired truth about God and man offered to it by the Church, it will inevitably become totalitarian, because it's necessary to have a conception of the end of man in order to have any conception of what human rights, the natural law are. And that conception of the end of man can only actually be given by revelation. Maritain makes a similar point, although I don't think his doctrine would be altogether compatible with what the Catechism says on that, but he makes a similar point in the 1930s in a book called Science and Wisdom. He says that the first principle in practical reasoning is the last end. So whereas in speculative reasoning, the first principles are self-evident to human reason, in practical reasoning, you have to work back from the last end. And in this universe, in this order of providence, the last end is supernatural and therefore has to be revealed. So a problem with your argument, as I understand it, is that one cannot make any kind of coherent contribution to a debate which is not at least based on natural reason, and that requires theism, because theism is an element of something knowable by natural reason. And the second difficulty is that, in fact, natural reason then points us to the fact that we need some sort of revelation in order to know what the first principle of practical reasoning is. And therefore, an agnostic, revealed discourse will ultimately fail to produce, in fact, not only will fail to produce the right conclusions and therefore the wrong rules, but will actually rightly produce the wrong rules, that simply being logical within a non-theistic context will lead to the kind of legislation that we now see.
Yes, but I fully agree with what you're saying and obviously what you're quoting, but that's not my point. My point is not that ultimately, the fullness, and this is what I've been saying, the fullness and the breadth and the depth of human rights can be understood without God. That is indeed, I agree with you, that's not possible. The only point I've been making is I've been saying in explaining the reality of the natural created order that is necessary to accept also as a basis for human right, it is possible to explain that in a sense, not going all the depth, but one can come away in explaining that without having, as I called it, overtly religious terms. So in a sense, there's much that reason, as Pope Benedict says, there's much that reason can explain to come toward that understanding, but that doesn't mean that that leads to the full understanding, because I fully agree with you, that indeed requires exactly what you say and what you quote. But I think we have to be careful also in our dialogue with secular society. We have to be very careful that we do not hide ourselves behind saying, well, you know, if I can't talk about God and if I can't, you know, always refer to God in this, I'm not going to explain this and I'm not going to be willing to talk about it. I think we do not deny anything, we do not reject anything of what you say, by also making an effort to, so to say, make the introduction to understanding this in the first steps of also using reason and then leading from there also to faith. So the one doesn't exclude the other. It's not, the whole point I'm trying to make is human rights are to a certain extent, you know, the human dignity, understanding of man is to a certain extent explainable by reason. But, as I've stressed again and again, ultimately, when God is not in the picture, you cannot come to his fullness. So that's the point. So
reason includes theism. It's not possible to make
I'm not excluding it. I'm just saying that there's a process there. That's the difference. But this is a deep discussion. I think we should let others also have some questions. Alexander, yes, and two more questions there. So Alexander was, and then yes, there. That's it.
A question more on the legal field. I'm very much worried about this flood of laws that are currently passed mm-hmm. by all kinds of institutions. And where would you draw a line, what a government should actually regulate by law and what not in context with human rights? Because one example, surrogate motherhood, for mm-hmm. instance. I mean, do we really have to regulate everything in law? Or, I mean, if something happens in society and it can happen for a while and people will see it's not good or they will see it's good, I don't know, do we really have to put that? I mean, can you draw the report?
That's a very good question, Alexander, because in fact this is the eternal dilemma for lawyers and politicians. And let me give you one example from my home country. I remember very well the discussion in the 80s when abortion was legalized in the Netherlands. This was exactly the discussion. Many people were saying, well, we shouldn't be legalizing it. We shouldn't be regulating it by law. You know, we shouldn't do anything because it's wrong anyway, so why shouldn't we do anything? The other side was saying, no, but if we don't do anything, you know, it becomes a chaos and things get out of hand and therefore we have to regulate an existing practice. Well, the problem with that argument is that we have seen in every instance that has happened, that has actually led to the problem becoming worse, not less. So abortion, for example, was legalized in many countries and also in the Netherlands by saying, well, you know, we have to regulate the practice and we're just going to limit it to these and these situations. Well, what happened is the moment the law came into force, you know, everybody started interpreting it broadly in whatever way they wanted, and that was the end of it, and soon it was complete common practice everywhere. So this is this dilemma. I can't give you a general answer to that because
it's life.
That's life. Yeah. No, but there
are some things are not life. I mean, like surrogate motherhood.
Right.
Nobody is killed. I mean, you just have the big problem that the child has no parents. I mean, no biological parents. Uh-huh. He has parents, but other ones also, etc., etc. So I mean, there are, and the same is with a lot of questions of research, etc. Do we really have to regulate all that?
Well, I have my doubts about it. But the reason why there seems to be, you know, this desire of our governments to regulate it is because a previous stage has not been taken care of, namely to avoid that from happening at all. And you know, because our governments have been quite lax in all these practices and suddenly letting them happen, things got out of hand, and then suddenly they are faced with a situation, a reality that suddenly requires, well, we have to do something about it for it even to get worse. So I think the problem lies before that. So, but it's a big dilemma. Last question.
Thank you very much, especially also what you said about death penalty, so I don't need to ask this question anymore. I would totally agree with you on that. My question was further, hoping not to open a new too big topic, but the question of just war theory. because what you said, when quoting in Shine, what you said about the state, that the state is not a person, but the people actual is the question for the people who live in this community. And if I was wondering if something like as a just war is ever possible in any theoretical, practical way, in a way that even if there might be a good goal or end of action, like to defend your country, to defend your family, or defend general interests, but the question is always, it is always against another life. So one life is then put higher than another life, when you said we can never weigh one life against another life. And in a war, it's individual, it's one person, one man killing each other, or in that way, how can this be justified in a way, or what would you say to this?
Well, this indeed opens a can of worms, and I think we should not go into this in depth at this point, because actually this might be an interesting subject for a class here at the ITI. You know, the whole just war theory, about which many of the great doctors that are studied here have said a lot of sensible things. But I would like to give one concrete example where, in my view, the so-called just war theory has been misused, and that's the Iraq War. I think that's a very clear example where at that time we heard a lot, you know, we have to defend ourselves and you know, against the terrorists and this and that and so and so. And it just caused so much more death and blood and misery that we're still living the consequences of. There you saw a very clear example of what I would say political misuse of that concept. And this is a problem what we've seen through history. There have been many wars that have been started under the theory of just war, but there was not anything really just about it. So it's a very tricky situation. I am absolutely not learned in that area, so I'm not gonna make a fool of myself saying anything unsensible about it, because I'm sure actually there might be people here who have a lot more to say about that. But it's a good question, but I think it goes outside of this evening.
Okay. Yes? It's a really brief question, because...
we were over with questions.
Sorry, no, it's just that you had mentioned earlier that the European Declaration on Human Rights, there wasn't really any firm foundation that everybody spoke from.
That's the Universal Declaration
of
Human Rights.
Sorry, Universal Declaration, sorry. So it seems like the real thing has been this hope push towards legal positivism and building.
Exactly.
And I wondered what your thoughts are. Should not the conversation be going to those prior principles and the philosophical foundations before the positive sort of law questions?
I agree, and that's what I've been trying to do tonight, is to give some of those pre-positive principles, and trying to explain why, if we lose these foundations, we basically lose the whole foundation of law, or as Benedict calls it, we use the basis for the exercise of justice. So this was where this talk was about. It's exactly, you know, that we are losing a study of the sources and understanding, you know, the sources that underpin the law. So yes, you're absolutely right. Thank you, and may just an announcement for all our guests, so outside ITI guests and faculty and staff members, we have for our guests a little agape in the Kaiser Karl room, so that we can continue a little bit the conversations, and the members of our faculty and staff are also invited to it. Thank you very much for bearing with me tonight.